This Washington Post Live podcast is sponsored by Northrop Grumman, the value of performance.
You're listening to a podcast from Washington Post Live, bringing the Post's newsroom to life on stage.
On Thursday, December 6th, the Washington Post held a Transformers Defense Summit headlined by Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joseph Dunford. General Dunford discussed how the Pentagon is modernizing America's armed forces and revealed key military challenges facing the country. Director of the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, Dr. Stephen H. Walker, assessed how the United States and other nations are reducing their reliance on traditional machinery of war fighting and adapting military strategy to next-generation technology. In this segment, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joseph Dunford, discusses key threats facing America now and in the future, and how the U.S. military is preparing for them. He discusses military modernization, emerging cyber threats, and the risks posed by our global adversaries. Let's listen.
Thanks, David. Thank you, General.
Thanks. It's a great pleasure for all of us at the Washington Post to have General Dunford with us today for this conversation. As in all of our conversations here, we invite the audience in the room streaming to send us any questions to the hashtag PostLive. Just to say a word about General Dunford, to me, he's been a symbol of continuity in our country in two ways I want to mention. First, he was initially appointed as chairman in 2015 under President Obama. He was reappointed in May by President Trump for a second two-year term. So there's that first continuity that really is a symbol of what endures in our country. Secondly, I note every few days, it seems, that General Dunford is talking with his counterparts around the world, from allied countries, from potential adversaries, and this continuity of military-to-military contacts, again, reminds me of what's continuous, what has nothing to do with the daily ups and downs that we're often reporting in the newspapers. So, General Dunford, thank you for coming. I want to begin with an area that you have focused on with the chiefs, with the administration, and that's looking anew at our peer competitors, the countries who would challenge us in renewed great power competition, obviously Russia and China. And I want to take each of those in turn and start with Russia and the events of several weeks ago that got all of our attention, in which the Russians intercepted and captured three Ukrainian vessels in the Kerch Strait in the area off the Ukraine coast, off Crimea. If you watched the tapes that were disseminated of that, you heard a Russian captain of one of these boats screaming and cursing as he drove his vessel right into the Ukrainian tug with an enormous crash. And I couldn't help but worry watching that about the Russian willingness to take risks. So I want to ask you, from a military standpoint, how did you read what happened in that incident? What did it tell you about the Russian military, about President Putin's willingness to use power? And what do you think we should do about it?
Sure. I think it says a lot about Russia's respect of international norms and standards. And what took place in the Sea of Azov is consistent with a pattern of behavior that really goes back to Georgia, the Crimea, and then the Donbass in the Ukraine. And what we refer to this as, competition that falls short of armed conflict, where what the Russians are really doing is testing the international community's resolve in enforcing the rules that exist. And in this case, clear violations of sovereignty have taken place. And that doesn't by any means indicate that there should be a military response. But I think that the international community certainly has got to respond diplomatically, economically, or in a security space, or Russia will continue to do what they've been doing now over the last couple of years.
So there have been calls in the aftermath of this for providing naval weaponry to the Ukrainians, who obviously were very vulnerable in this incident. The administration decided to provide Javelin anti-tank weapons to deal with Ukrainian vulnerabilities. What do you think, again, from a military standpoint, about the utility of having those kinds of missiles? Would that be stabilizing or destabilizing?
First of all, our relationship with the Ukraine is really focused in two areas. One is we're assisting them with reforming their defense, and I'm now speaking just to the military dimension. And the second is we have equipped them with capabilities that allow them to defend themselves. There is not, so we don't confuse the two issues, there is not a discussion ongoing right now about a military dimension in response to the Sea of Azov. Obviously, my job in uniform is to make sure that the president has options available should he decide to respond with military force. But there's been no military response, nor has there been a discussion about a military response to the Sea of Azov in public. And again, our focus with the Ukraine is we believe that the Ukraine's sovereignty is something that's sacrosanct, and we've assisted them in defending their sovereignty.
You talk often, as I indicated earlier, with your Russian counterpart, General Gerasimov. And I'm curious whether you've had conversations since this incident and about this incident to try to establish some understandings, rules of the road. Has that happened?
No, I have. I do speak to him fairly regularly. We've met three times since I've been on my assignment. We've communicated many times by telephone. A couple of things I would say about that. One is the nature of our conversation is designed to mitigate the risk calculation with Russia, and then in the event of a crisis, help manage a crisis. And you referred to in your opening comments, David, Syria, and we obviously have had spoken a great deal about deconfliction in Syria, but we also have spoken a lot about ensuring that incidents at sea or incidents in the air don't precipitate a crisis. So rules of the road, if you will, that pertain to our forces at sea and our forces in the air. I haven't spoken specifically about this incident. And typically, were I to communicate on an incident like this, it would be to deliver U.S. policy. And right now, that, you know, whatever messages we're delivering are being delivered by our political leadership.
If this audience could listen in on one of your conversations with General Gerasimov, would we be reassured that there's more stability and continuity in this relationship than it sometimes seems?
Sure. The one thing I would say to the audience is we've worked very hard to ensure that our relationship doesn't become politicized. I think we're both very aware of the nature of our political relationship right now between the two countries. And we both are committed to maintaining lines of communication. I think his perspective is similar to mine in terms of the risk of miscalculation and making sure that we have open lines of communication. And to the extent that we can, some degree of transparency that would mitigate the risk of miscalculation. I think that while I have never spoken publicly about the substance of the phone call, and one thing you should be comforted by is that we conclude each phone call with a commitment to each other not to publicly discuss the nature of our phone call. And I'm now 3 years plus into this relationship, and never once has that been violated. In fact, we inadvertently violated it once when I shared the information with somebody else who shared it and it went public. And so the only violation of our commitment not to share information was something that we did inadvertently. I would just say about General Gerasimov, he's a military professional. We clearly have challenges reconciling the political differences between our two countries. But in terms of military commitments, military discussion, and trying to do the best we can to support our political leadership and give them the decision space necessary to work through some tough issues, I think we have contributed to stability with that line of communication. And certainly in Syria, without going into too much detail now, we certainly can later if you want to, but the communications between General Gerasimov and myself have been very important for us to deconflict operations in Syria. And by deconflict, what I really mean is that has allowed us in a very complicated, complex battle space. It's allowed us to prosecute the campaign against ISIS while deconflicting with a large presence of Russian forces on the ground as well, and obviously regime forces writ large.
So I should just take this moment to ask you about Syria. Are we now finally, after this long nightmare of war, heading toward some stabilization of Syria? Do you see that ahead?
Sure. Well, you know, we go back to the beginning in the fall of 2015, and you certainly were paying very close attention to it during that particular time. In the fall of 2015, I think we'd be having a very different conversation about ISIS, and they hold about 2% of the ground that they held in Iraq and Syria back in 2015. We've reduced the flow of foreign fighters in and out of Syria and Iraq significantly since that time, and they have access to far less resources, and I think I would argue as well, harder to measure, but the narrative has less credibility than it did back in 2015. So they hold less physical ground. Their narrative is probably resonating a bit less. I am not at all complacent about the work that remains to be done. So we've largely cleared, except for the last vestiges of ISIS in the Euphrates River Valley, we've largely cleared the physical manifestation of ISIS inside of Syria. That doesn't mean there aren't still thousands of fighters in Syria. And the work that remains to be done, and the word that you use, stabilization, to me what that means is we've got to complete the training of local forces that can prevent ISIS from coming back. And then in conjunction with our State Department partners, we've got to make sure that there's effective local governance. And then services being provided. And I'm not talking about reconstruction, but I'm talking about basic water, sewage, power, jobs, those kinds of things that need to be done in order for us to say that the area has been stabilized. So I would say we're well along in clearing ISIS from the ground that they've held in Syria, and we still have a lot of work to do in terms of the stabilization phase.
And just a final question of special interest to me, because I've been lucky enough to travel with our special forces in eastern Syria a number of times. How much longer do you expect they'll stay there? We have the sense that something under 2,000 special operations forces are still in eastern Syria, that they're there on a indeterminate, unspecified timeline. What would you say about how much longer you think?
Yeah, the one thing that I've probably gained some humility over the last few years about projecting timelines, and so I won't do that. I will give you some idea of the order of magnitude of the work to be done. We estimate, for example, about 35,000 to 40,000 local forces have to be trained and equipped in order to provide stability. We're probably somewhere on along the line of 20% through the training of those forces. So we've trained and equipped forces that have cleared. Those are combat forces, Syrian Democratic Forces, a balance of Arab and Kurdish forces who have done the majority of the fighting in Syria against ISIS. But with regard to stabilization, we still have a long way to go. And so I'd be reluctant to affix a time. I would highlight, though, that our military campaign is designed to do two things. One is to defeat ISIS, and that includes the stabilization that we just discussed. And the other is to provide support to Secretary Pompeo in the diplomatic efforts that he has to resolve the Syrian civil war, and that is through a Geneva process, the United Nations Geneva process. And so our presence in Syria is associated not only with the ISIS fight, but also in support of the diplomatic effort of Secretary Pompeo. And that's why it's difficult for me to speculate as to how long we might be there. But certainly the conditions have changed a great deal over the last 3 years, and I think we are certainly at a point where we can say that the presence we have in Syria right now is sustainable and can be adjusted based on conditions.
Well, I'm going to take away from that they're not leaving anytime soon, or at least that you don't have that in prospect. Which
no, that's right.
For friends of Syrian stability is probably good news. Let me ask you a final question about Russia, and that involves the announced U.S. intention to leave the INF Treaty and the concerns that I think are widely shared that we may be heading into a new arms race with Russia in strategic weapons. I want to ask you whether you think, again, as the president's chief military advisor, that it would be useful to have some discussion again of arms control that could fill in the gaps that are obviously there in the INF Treaty and in other areas. Is this a time when we should be thinking again about what kind of arms control dialogue should we have?
Sure. That's a great question. And first, what I would say is that, conceptually, I believe that the arms control agreements that we've had in the past have contributed to strategic stability. I think there can be no doubt about that. The regime of arms control agreements that really began in earnest in the 1980s have provided a degree of strategic stability. The issue is that in order to have strategic stability as an outcome of arms control, both parties have to be compliant with the agreement. And we have now for 3 or 4 years highlighted Russia's non-compliance with the INF treaty. And then Secretary Pompeo this week at NATO indicated that within 60 days, we will suspend our compliance with the INF treaty unless Russia comes into compliance. He emphasized that our strongest desire is that Russia does come into compliance. And again, this is a message that has been delivered fairly consistently now over a couple of years. We've been public about it. We've been public with our allies about the concerns with the INF. In a perfect world, what I would say is that it'd be best if Russia would comply with the INF, which would set the conditions for a broader conversation about other arms control agreements to include the extension of START. I will not obviously make this decision. I'll make recommendations, but it's very difficult for me to envision progress in extending START 2, as an example, if the foundation of that is non-compliance with the INF treaty. And so I think working our way through the INF treaty, bringing Russia back into compliance, ought to be what's in all of our interests. And were that to be the case, then I think we can begin to have a conversation about mechanisms that can contribute to strategic stability in the 21st century, much like it did in the 20th century. Conditions have changed. Weapons have changed. Some capabilities have been fielded or will be fielded, weren't even envisioned when the current regime of arms control was put in place. And so those are pretty difficult issues in and of themselves. And if you don't have a foundation of compliance with yesterday's treaties, it's very difficult to talk about tomorrow.
Is there still time for that discussion about how Russia could meet our compliance concerns? Still time for that to take place? The clock is ticking, and this one's about to, you know, this train's about to leave. What do you think?
I think Secretary Pompeo's presentation in Brussels, which was very consistent with the discussion that took place in the G20, was designed as one last effort to afford the Russians the opportunity to become compliant. So he didn't say we were suspending our compliance with the treaty. He said that within 60 days we will suspend our compliance if Russia doesn't come into compliance. And I think also there was an effort there to make sure that there's many voices speaking to Russia right now, not the least of which is the voice of NATO as a whole, the 29 nations of NATO, all highlighting for Russia the concerns about non-compliance with the INF and the implications for European security.
So let's turn to China, the other peer competitor. And General, I have the feeling that when we think about China, in some ways we're thinking for the first time in our modern history about a genuine peer in the future, a country that's as rich as we are, that's as technologically sophisticated as we are, a country that really can challenge us in a way that, frankly, Russia and the Soviet Union never entirely could except through their nuclear weapons. And so I want to ask you, as you think about China, to describe for us what kind of military capability you think they're trying to build. Do they want to challenge us globally? Do they want to challenge us regionally? How do you think about this?
Sure. First, when we look at ourselves, the U.S. military, we think there are two main areas that give us a competitive advantage. One is the network of allies and partners that we built up since World War II. The other has been the historic ability to project power when and where necessary to advance our interests. And in that latter area, which is specifically the military dimension of our source of strength, we have been largely uncontested over the last few decades. That changed. That changed in the past decade. I would argue that China, we spoke about Russia a minute ago, but both China and Russia studied what we did in Desert Shield, Desert Storm, certainly took a hard look at what we did throughout the air campaigns in the late 1990s, and certainly looked at what we did in 2003 in our ability to project vast amounts of equipment, material, people around the world relatively quickly. So they have focused on denying the United States the ability to project power into the Pacific and then operate freely across what we call all domains. That's Pentagon speak for sea, air, land, space, and cyberspace. And I think what's fair to say, and it really gets at the heart of your question, is China has developed capabilities in all of those domains that challenge us. And the outcome of challenging us across those old domains is challenging our ability to project power in support of our interests and our alliances in the region. And so what we have to do on the military side is we believe that conventional deterrence has rested on that ability to project power when and where necessary to achieve our interests. The strength of our alliances has depended on that in the sense that our allies know that we can respond and we can meet our alliance commitments because of our ability to project power and then operate freely once we get to that area. So I think from a military perspective, the way I would frame the problem is, one, it's our responsibility to develop capabilities that assure our ability to project power and then operate freely across all those domains. China, in his large debates about how much China is spending in their capability development, and with the recognition that it's fairly opaque, both China's fiscal, the investments they make, as well as the capabilities they develop, I think what's not in dispute is over the last 10 years, they have significantly advanced what in the Pentagon they describe as anti-access area denial capabilities. And what that really gets at is that ability of the United States to move into an area and, again, operate freely once we get there. And that's a critical element, again, of deterrence and then our ability to respond in the event that deterrence would fail. I would also remind everyone that's listening that we have five treaty allies in the Pacific, and you know, these are allies that we have a hard commitment to their security. And so when we talk about projecting power and being able to operate freely across all domains, what we're really talking about is our ability to meet the requirements of those five treaties.
Just to drill down on this, when you think about the future, when you read about Chinese efforts to build port facilities in Pakistan or Djibouti or this place or that, do you envision, let's say, a Chinese Navy that will seek to be a global blue water Navy, like what the United States developed, or do you think that their ambitions are different, that we shouldn't see them in terms of competing with us in each of these spheres?
Sure. I would lean towards the former, not the latter, despite the fact that China has been opaque in terms of what they're spending on defense and what specific capabilities they may be investing in at any given time. They've been very transparent about their aspirations. So if we listen to Xi Jinping last year at the Communist Party Committee, he was pretty clear about wanting China to be a global power with global power projection capability. And among the capabilities of developing are aircraft carriers, which would certainly indicate a desire to project power beyond their territorial waters.
So one particular area of potential Chinese power is at the frontier of military technology, and that's artificial intelligence.
Sure.
All of the systems, the autonomous weapon systems, the algorithms that will drive warfare, that the Chinese seem particularly eager to dominate. You mentioned Xi Jinping's speech last fall. That was at the center, this idea that China will command the technological heights in the future. And I want to ask you to talk a little bit about how you see AI transforming your business of military power, and whether you worry that we're not doing enough given its apparent importance to get our focus set on meeting this Chinese challenge.
First of all, when I in our profession, one of the areas that's going to really determine future outcomes is speed of decision making, and so AI is certainly relevant to speed of decision making. If you think about cyberspace, AI is critical to being able to implement effective ways of protecting ourselves in cyberspace. If you think about operating in that environment I spoke earlier, the anti-access area denial, and you talk about capacity sufficient to be able to operate in a very complex operating environment, man-machine teaming is obviously a critical element. And I don't think it would be an overstatement when we talk about artificial intelligence to say that whoever has a competitive advantage in artificial intelligence and can field systems informed by artificial intelligence could very well have an overall competitive advantage. I mean, I think it may be that important. I don't think it's something we can say definitively at this point, but it's certainly going to inform and be the preponderance of the variables that would go into, hey, who has an overall competitive advantage? AI will be a key piece of it. And with regard to whether we're doing enough, I would just tell you in this and so many areas, I would never be complacent in telling you that we're doing enough. You know, we are clearly in a competition for a competitive advantage. And without exaggeration, I mean, I can tell you that our overall competitive advantage has reduced over the past 10 or 12 years. 10 or 12 years ago, whoever was sitting in my seat could have said that we are uncontested in all domains, uncontested in our ability to project power when and where necessary. I can't say that today. What I can say is that we can defend the homeland and our way of life. We can meet our alliance commitments today, and we have an aggregate competitive advantage over any potential adversary. I'm equally confident in saying that if we don't change the trajectory that we were on for that 10-year period between about 2002, 2003 to 2015 or 16, so even maybe a bit more than 10 years, if we don't change that trajectory, who's ever sitting in my seat 5 or 7 years from now will not be as confident as I am. So the trajectory has been in the wrong direction, and technologies like artificial intelligence are going to be a critical element to our ability to be to have a competitive advantage in the future. And again, when I benchmark our competitive advantage, I really talk about things like conventional deterrence, our ability to respond effectively if deterrence fails.
Let me ask you about one of the trickiest parts of this competitive problem going forward. One thing the Chinese can command is the very best brain power in China to work on these problems in ways that serve the government. Our arguably best AI company, Google, was asked and agreed to be part of a Pentagon program called Project Maven, where Google computer scientists would write algorithms that would be useful for Pentagon warfighters. And the employees of Google learned of this and rebelled. I think that's the only way to put it. And there was a petition campaign, and all of a sudden, Google decided that because of its employees' unhappiness, they were going to have to back out of Project Maven. And so just to put it to you simply, what would you say to Google employees if they were watching this streaming, or employees at Microsoft or Amazon, for that matter? What would the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff say about the need for this brain power?
Sure. First thing I'd say, in very simple terms, were they all sitting here right now, I'd say, hey, we're the good guys. We are the good guys. And it's inexplicable to me that we would make compromises in order to advance our business interests in China, where we know that freedoms are restrained, where we know that China will take intellectual property from companies, strip that away, put the companies in the dustbin of history, and then use that intellectual property for their own advantage. We know those things are taking place. And so it's inexplicable to me that we wouldn't have a cooperative relationship with the private sector. I would also say that if you look at the world order that we have enjoyed since World War II, and you look at the values that are represented in that world order, we have been arguably the leader of the free world, since World War II. Were we not to have the capability of leading the free world and advancing the values and interests that reflect our country's values and interests and the Western world's values and interests, there will be alternatives to create an alternative order. And I'm not sure that the people at Google will enjoy a world order that is informed by the norms and standards of Russia or China, using the two examples that we discussed earlier. So that's what I think I would share with the people at Google, is that, again, we are the good guys in the sense that we do stand for what's right. We might make mistakes from time to time, but, you know, our record of standing up for principles of sovereignty, our record of standing up for human rights, our record of standing up for freedom of navigation and access to the global commons, I think, is uncontested. If you look at it over the course of 70 years, if you highlight a single incident here or there, well, you can see where humans have made mistakes. But if you look at it over the course of 70 years, I think it's indisputable what we have stood for. So if you believe in what we have stood for over the past 70 years, then you need to understand that that has only been possible because of the relationship that the U.S. military has enjoyed with industry. And one of the, you know, I talk about competitive advantages. One of the competitive advantages the U.S. military has enjoyed for decades has been that public partner, private partnership, where we have been able to leverage the full human capital and the ideas of the American people. And if we don't have access to that, we are not going to be competitive.
That's a pretty stark statement. You're basically saying if that connection is broken, we cannot compete at the level that we traditionally have known.
Well, at best, we're playing with one hand behind our back, right? I mean, again, if you believe what I believe, and you look back at our experience in the past, that relationship with industry, the fact that human capital is unleashed in our country, that ideas can rise to the top and we can be out in front. It's not a mistake that academically and intellectually we've led the world. That's because of our former government, and absent the ability to tap into Silicon Valley and have those kinds of relationships, we will not have that advantage that we've traditionally enjoyed. I think that's really the point I'm trying to make.
I want to come closer to home, in fact, right at home. And that's to ask you about the deployment of regular U.S. military troops to the border in November. That was something that I guess was actually in late October.
Right.
That was a decision that surprised a lot of people. And as we've looked at what those troops have been doing, General, frankly, it looks an awful lot more like a paramilitary set of tasks, the sort of thing that National Guard or law enforcement personnel do, than what you ask our uniformed military to do. So I want to ask you why you, as chairman, thought it was appropriate to go along with that order,
sure,
President, and how much longer this is going to last.
Sure. Let me walk back to what problem we're trying to solve. So the Department of Homeland Security has the primary responsibility for enforcing the border. Department of Homeland Security indicated to the president they had gaps in their capability. Those gaps included engineering capability to reinforce the points of entry. It included rotary wing helicopter support and, in some cases, fixed wing aircraft to move their people around. And they had some medical shortfalls and some logistics shortfalls. Those are all things that a resident in the Department of Defense. And so we worked very closely with Secretary Nielsen to refine exactly what capabilities she needed us to provide. And then the president gave us a legal order to support the Department of Homeland Security. David, I would tell you that we're at a hurricane, we're at a fire. We routinely provide what are called Title 10 forces, active duty U.S. military forces, to support the Department of Homeland Security. We go all around the world to respond in the wake of an earthquake, to respond in the wake of a natural disaster with U.S. military capabilities, to do things that they are not primarily trained, organized, and equipped to do, but they have the capability and capacity to support. So to me, one, it was a legal order to support the Department of Homeland Security. The mission was absolutely clear. The troops had the proper training to execute that mission, and the rules of engagement were clear to me. And so when you ask why it starts with why did I support it, because it was a legal order, and why am I not concerned about it is because those things are all in place. I mean, when I look at recommendations to use military forces, it starts with, is the mission clear? Do our people have the wherewithal to accomplish that mission? That's training and equipment. And are the conditions under which they're operating clear enough for me to provide them guidance on how they should conduct themselves under those conditions? And it met all of those criteria.
And what I hear you saying, just to close this out, is that you do not have authority as chairman to refuse a lawful order, whatever you may think about that order.
No, that's right. And I think the American people would not want generals to be making policy decisions and wouldn't want generals to determine when we should use force. You'd expect me to provide advice to our political leadership about how to use the military instrument. You'd expect me to provide advice about the appropriateness of using the military instrument under certain conditions. But if I receive a lawful order, I think the American people would expect me to execute that. And I think it'd be problematic were generals to start to make decisions based on one political party or another being in office and say, no, I don't really like that, and so I'm not going to do that. To me, it comes down to, is it a legal order? Now, if I had a concern, you know, based on principle, you only have really one choice, is to obey a lawful order or to resign. And I can't imagine too many conditions where I would resign if given a lawful order, since my code kind of tells me that Lance Corporals and PFCs and seamen can't resign when they're told what to do if it's a lawful order. And in my own code, informed a bit by General Marshall, and you know, we all point to him as kind of one of the North Stars of civil-military relations. When I look at civil-military relations in a democracy, that's kind of where I land.
I want to turn to another really interesting but also controversial issue, and that is the president's desire to create a space force. President Trump, and this is an area where I have some sympathy with his views, actually, has felt that the Air Force wasn't moving fast enough, that we were not responding to challenges in space. And so he said, I want to create a new branch of the military. And you were in the room when he made this announcement. And as I remember, he looked right at you and said, you got that, General? So he didn't leave any doubt about.
I recall about saying, "I got that."
Well, so the question I think we all have is, where is this now heading?
Sure,
We've had a kind of official set of reactions, but I think we're puzzled as to whether you think the Joint Staff thinks you ought to be heading toward something like a corps. Forgive me, a Marine Corps. Former Marine Corps Commandant, you know, something like the Marine Corps that would be space, but it would be under the Air Force as the Marines are under the Navy. Whether you can just take Space Command and shoot some steroids into it and kind of make that work. What are you thinking right now?
Sure. First, you know, let's, if we can, just stipulate that, and if we talk military operations, space is increasingly important, and there's no question about that. So the basic, what problem we're trying to solve is to make sure that we have the proper organizational construct to deal with space. And there's three main areas in that regard. One is making sure we most effectively use the capabilities that we have currently fielded. The second problem we're trying to solve is to make sure we have the right organizational construct to develop the capabilities that we need tomorrow. And the third is really the service type functions of training people, recruiting people, retaining people, growing people, all the things that you might associate with a service. So those are the three main elements that we're when we look at space, we're trying to solve those three problems. With regard to the first problem, we've already moved out, and we will, in 2019, establish a unified command. What that means is, you know, we today have what we call functional commands, and they're really commands that have global responsibilities. United States Strategic Command that has the nuclear enterprise is one example. United States Special Operations is another example. United States Cyber Command is another example. Transportation Command is another example. Each of those commands has a four-star that is responsible, works directly from a command authority's perspective for the Secretary of Defense. And we do that to elevate those particular functions to the right level, to make sure that the right voice is there to employ our capabilities and provide advice to the Secretary. So we will, in 2019, elevate space to a unified command. There will be a four-star in charge. That four-star's responsibility will take all of the resident capability that we have inside the Department of Defense today, uniform military capability, put it under one single commander so that we most effectively employ that. The second two problems, to develop capability and then come up with the right organizational construct, will result from a legislative proposal that will come from the president to the Congress, and the outcome will result on the dialogue that takes place between the president and the Congress on what is the right approach, what is the right organizational construct to get after those second two issues. The first issue is a responsibility I was given. We're moving out. We have already, you know, kind of moved behind the scenes to develop that organization. We've conducted two tabletop exercises to inform how we'll do that, and we'll have a major exercise in February and March to refine our understanding of what Space Command will look like and what the right command relationships will be and so forth. And then that legislative proposal, I would imagine, would come out sometime in 2019. Again, that'll be a legislative proposal from the president to the Congress, and I imagine in subsequent budget years is when it will be addressed.
So really, the details of this are still basically to be announced, subject to the president and Congress making a joint decision.
That's right.
Until you get that, work. It's kind of, as you said.
On the second, yeah, until we get that, it isn't that we're not doing anything. There's already an organization inside the United States Air Force that's responsible for capability development in space, so that's already being taken care of. And the United States Air Force, Navy, and the Army, for that matter, all have components that have space capabilities. So what we're talking about is, would we change that because we view there's a more optimal arrangement to develop capabilities for tomorrow and to manage our space force, space people. And I think everybody has probably concluded that we can make some changes in those two areas to be better and to make sure we're out in front of space as an emerging separate domain, if you will, warfighting domain, again, one of the five. And you've seen some of the options, and so I'd probably just tease you with a few of them. I mean, look, you can establish a separate department of space with a separate service inside of that department, so a completely separate organization.
I think the president wants new uniforms. I mean,
you can create a separate service inside the Department of the Air Force as a second approach to that. And so there's many ways to do that. And I think what we'll see is a legislative proposal. The vice president is chairing the Space Council. This issue is being discussed in the context of the Space Council. And like I said, so fair to say there's some details remaining. But I wouldn't want to leave you with nothing's happened since the president's speech. Quite a bit has happened to include our progress in standing up a separate command to make sure we're most effectively employing the capabilities that we have today.
We only have about 5 minutes left, and there are a couple of important things that I want to get to. And one of them is Saudi Arabia. Here at the Washington Post, as everyone knows, we feel deeply the loss of our colleague and friend, Jamal Khashoggi, who was murdered in Istanbul in October. Since then, there has been a lot of turbulence, to put it mildly, in the U.S.-Saudi relationship. And I'm wondering whether that is will affect the U.S.-Saudi military relationship. And specifically, General, I want to ask you about the war in Yemen.
Sure.
And what your own military advice is as members of Congress, seek your views, members of the administration, that war is a humanitarian nightmare. I'm just stating what everybody knows, and it may get worse. What kind of advice are you offering? First, about the relationship with Saudi Arabia. Second, what to do in Yemen.
Yeah, no. With regard to Saudi Arabia, I mean, Saudi Arabia is no different than any other country in the sense that the military-to-military relationship that we have with a given country is completely informed by our policy. And so there's been no change in our policy with regard to Saudi Arabia that has informed our military-to-military relationship to date. And I mean this sincerely, express my condolences both to the Post and his family. I've seen his family many times on television and read what they have written in the Post and other periodicals. And so if the policy changes, our military-to-military relationship changes. We have historically had a strong military-to-military relationship with Saudi Arabia. It has been historically a fact that Saudi Arabia's contribution to security and stability in the Middle East is important, and so we have approached our military-to-military relationship with that in mind. With regard to Yemen, I think it's probably important to clarify, U.S. military operations in Yemen are focused on two things, ISIS and al-Qaeda. We are not a participant in the civil war, nor are we supporting one side of the civil war or the other. My advice has been to continue to support Martin Griffiths. The good news is there is an ongoing discussion in Sweden this week, which is, you know, hope springs eternal, but arguably one of the more important diplomatic developments in a few years with regard to Yemen is that the parties are actually in Sweden, and there's a framework that gives us some reasonable expectation of an outcome that advances the situation in Yemen to some degree. But again, I would continue to recommend that we are not a participant in the civil war in Yemen, and we remain an honest broker, if you will, with the ability to contribute to a diplomatic solution in Yemen. There is not a military solution. You've covered that as much as anybody has. There's not a purely military solution in Yemen, as just like there isn't any complex contingency of the sort of Yemen. And so our military advice is focused on al-Qaeda and in ISIS and making sure we have the partnerships in the region to make sure we can disrupt what has been over the last few years the most insidious strain of al-Qaeda, which has been al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and obviously concerned about ISIS there and as we are elsewhere.
There have been calls increasingly from Congress to cut off military sales to Saudi Arabia. Again, strictly from a military standpoint, what would be the consequences of that in terms of regional security, in your view?
Yeah, I think that it's fair to say that Saudi Arabia would be less capable without access to U.S. technology and capability. I will not weigh in on whether or not we ought to do that, because the military dimension in this case is but one of the considerations that our nation is going to have to make when determining whether or not to continue to sell weapons to Saudi Arabia. Right now, there's been no change in our policy, and so that's what we're doing. But I do understand the debate that's taking place with regard to whether or not we'll do that in the future. And again, most of the considerations are very important, but they're not military considerations.
So I have one last question. In some ways, it's probably the hardest one, and that's Afghanistan. This is a war that's been going on now for 17 years. You were in Afghanistan earlier this year, and I think you said you thought we were making progress. We have just been through a period in which the cost in American lives has seemed to spike up again. There are efforts underway to try to find some negotiated settlement of the conflict. But at what point, General Dunford, would you say, as chairman, it's time to stop putting American soldiers' lives at risk in Afghanistan and begin to draw that down? In your mind, I know you don't like timetables, but I'm sure that there is a point at which a military commander says, "That's it. We're not gonna spend another American life in a particular conflict."
Look, it's a fair question. It's a good question, and certainly this week, having lost five soldiers in the past 2 weeks, a question that weighs heavily on all of our minds. And it isn't that we don't every day think about that. What I would say about Afghanistan, we got to go back on a fundamental assumption. And this is an assumption I make, and we can argue this assumption, but it's an assumption I make, and it's informed by the intelligence. Were we not to put the pressure on al-Qaeda, ISIS, and other groups in the region that we are putting on today, it is our assessment that in a period of time, their capability would reconstitute, and they have today the intent, and they in the future would have the capability to do what we saw on 9/11. So when I look at Afghanistan, it starts with that assumption in mind. So again, people can argue that assumption. So what problem am I trying to solve has less to do with security and stability in Afghanistan than it does first and foremost with making recommendations for the employment of military force that protects the American people, the homeland, and our allies. So that's where we start. And it's my judgment that the presence that we've had in Afghanistan has, in fact, disrupted the enemy's ability to reconstitute and pose a threat to us. And we assess this probably for those that don't pay close attention to Afghanistan on a routine basis. There are 20 trans-regional terrorist groups operating in and around the South Asia area. So the question is, to me, not when we should leave. I believe we have enduring interests in South Asia, and we will have an enduring diplomatic presence, enduring economic presence, and enduring security presence in South Asia. The real debate ought to be, what is the character of that presence? And today, my recommendations on the character of our presence are informed by my assessment of the threat in the region and the level of effort that is required to disrupt threats to the homeland. And were the Afghan forces capable on their own of dealing with ISIS and al-Qaeda, and were we to have a political reconciliation, which is our long-term end state in Afghanistan, political reconciliation that would set the conditions for us to adjust our force posture, I think all of us would be happy. But in my judgment today, in order to achieve our political objectives, the force that's on the ground, the level of advising, assisting that we're providing, the capabilities that we're providing to enable Afghans to take the fight to the Taliban are necessary for one piece of our strategy, which is military pressure. And I'll just give you the theory of the case. The theory of the case in Afghanistan is that we will put sufficient political pressure, sufficient social pressure, and sufficient military pressure on the Taliban such that they will reconcile an Afghan-owned, Afghan-led reconciliation process. When people said that I said that things were moving better, what was left out of that conversation was the full context of my conversation. So what I said was that with regard to political pressure, the recent elections were another element in terms of being positive in putting political pressure on the Taliban. Social pressure, I was encouraged by the fact that imams in Indonesia, in Pakistan, and in Saudi Arabia had issued fatwas that truly, I think, advanced the case of the Afghan government. And the third piece was, I believe that with the changes we made in the South Asia strategy and the conditions-based approach that NATO and our partners took, and the fact that we were willing to provide resources to support the Afghan National Defense Security Forces through 2024, which was a decision made at the NATO meeting last summer. What I said was that, in my judgment, particularly with some of the initiatives in the diplomatic track, the pressure on the Taliban was moving in the right direction. And we were seeing, for the first time, certainly in many, many years, we were seeing some opportunities to initiate that Afghan-owned, Afghan-led reconciliation process. I am very measured in terms of making predictions about where we are in that process. I think anybody that has studied negotiations know that you really never know where you are in a negotiation until it's over. And so there is plenty of work to be done with regard to an Afghan-owned, Afghan-led reconciliation process. But my judgment, continuing to bring to bear that political, social, and military pressure is necessary. And to be honest with you, I have not recommended that we leave Afghanistan because, again, in my judgment, leaving Afghanistan not only would create instability in South Asia, but in my judgment would give terrorist groups the space within which to plan and conduct operations against the American people, the homeland, and our allies. And that really is the problem we're trying to solve. And I would tell you, for those critical of what we're doing, you know, my level of confidence that I had all the answers when I was a second lieutenant was way up here. And my level of confidence that I have all the answers today based on my experiences is way down here. And so there's an inverse relationship. So if someone has a better idea than we have right now, which is continue to support the Afghans and continue to put pressure on those terrorist groups in the region, I'm certainly open to a dialogue on that.
Great conversation. I'll be back in a few minutes for a discussion with the DARPA director, Stephen Walker. But for now, we'll move on to the next portion of our program. Before we do that, please join me in thanking our terrific speaker, General Dunford.
Thanks very much. Thanks. Thanks, David.
Couldn't have been better.
Thanks for listening. To hear more interviews from this series and other Washington Post Live programs, visit us at WashingtonPostLive.com.